The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, thanks for having me, Peter and CBF. It's great to be here and to be talking today to you about God and politics. I mean, as Peter said, it couldn't be better timed, with all the turmoil swirling around us in Canberra, with the possibility of yet another Prime Minister of Australia. So we live in an age, it's a truism, isn't it, that we live in an age in which politics has become suddenly alarming and fascinating all at once. With the election of Trump, with the rise of One Nation, and the Brexit referendum in the United Kingdom, and in our own nation, the turmoil just of this last week, many people feel a growing sense of uncertainty and alarm. The extremes in politics seem to be becoming more powerful. We've lost the ability to disagree with one another, whether that be in the public square or on university campuses or via the internet. We've lost the ability to disagree civilly with one another, and there's a profound disagreement about the future shape of human societies, with euthanasia legislation before many of the parliaments of our nation even as we speak. Instead of working out compromise, we now simply shout at, ban, boycott, shame, hound, no platform, and harass those with whom we disagree. And I don't know about you, but I have a Twitter account, and every now and again I make the stupid mistake of trying to engage someone in debate on Twitter, and then I feel dirty afterwards. I feel like I need to take a bath after engaging there. The New York Times, I feel like the only way you can engage there is by doing the kind of things I've just described, shouting at people, because that's all the amount of words you've got, and that's the kind of thing it trades in. It actually inflames disagreement in its incivility. And now, New York Times columnist David Brooks has recently said that we are seeing a politics fueled by alienation. There's a widespread feeling that politics isn't delivering what many people aspire to. People feel excluded from the system. And as Brooks says, and that can be on the right and the left, by the way, it doesn't matter what your orientation is, people just feel excluded. Or there's a sort of mythology, a self-mythology, that I'm excluded from the system of politics. My vote doesn't count for much. Or when I vote, it's really being manipulated by the Russians or by Facebook or by Facebook using the Russians or by Russians using Facebook or whatever it is. The alienated, says David Brooks, the alienated long for something that will smash the system or change the situation. And so what we get is people voting for smash-through solutions at both ends of the political spectrum. Smash-through solutions. In the age of the quick fix, Thomas Friedman wrote that, in fact, this is a great sign of a cult of anxiety, that we live in an anxious time, and one of the, he says, it's displayed by the fact that we're after smash through leaders to kind of crash into the system and change it absolutely, and that's a sign of anxiety. Now, lots of people would feel, maybe you're in this camp, that religion adds fuel to the already smouldering pile of sticks that is contemporary politics. People who are religious seem to think that they can force everyone else to accept their vision of a good and just society. But then they turn to the Bible as their source book, and if you don't believe the Bible, you can't even talk to them. They're beyond conversation. So Senator Penny Wong, a couple of years ago, expressed a very common view when she said, "Religious freedom means being free to worship and to follow your faith without suffering persecution or discrimination for your beliefs. It does not mean imposing your beliefs on everyone else, and it most emphatically does not mean deploying the power of the state to enforce one set of religious beliefs. One's own views should not determine the rights of others." I do note that she thinks that her views should determine the rights of others, but you know, she's in power. So here we are in a religious gathering of a kind talking about Christian politics or God and politics, a topic which sounds like it's going to be controversial from the start. Should there even be such a thing? Shouldn't people keep their religious views private and personal? Shouldn't Christians in particular keep their noses out of the public sphere? And if we're to be honest, Christians don't even seem to be able to agree who to vote for themselves. I know faithful, committed Christians who are passionate liberals, adamant ALP voters, committed Greens, vocal Christian Democrats, and rusted on One Nation supporters. Where I live in Darling Point, of course, you can after any election, you can check what votes were delivered in any one booth, and our church has a booth, right? So I go and I check who voted for what in our booth, and it's something like, of course, 95% vote for the Liberals, but there's always two or three Christian Democrats and two or three Greens, and I know who those people are in any way. I'm married to one. I won't, and I'm the father of another. Won't tell you which.
One Nation?
So, no, not in One Nation. Shouldn't we put, and this is a bit down market for Darling Point, shouldn't we just put politics aside and keep our faith separate? We did pray once for the Queen in as Anglicans always have done, in our Book of Common Prayer service, and I received an angry letter from a visitor saying, "How dare you bring politics into church?" And I said, "Well, the Anglicans have been doing this since the 16th century, so you know this is traditional. It's just I'm just going by what the Anglican prayer book says." Well, I want to say today that Christianity is 100% political, but not quite in the way we mostly assume. Certainly, I think your faith should inform the way you vote, but I don't have a simple formula for how that works out on voting day. And I think I would be suspicious of me if I did say that. But a Christian politics begins a long way back of who you choose to vote for. Now, I love British politics in particular, probably more than Australian politics. And when I was following the last general election, which was another astonishing episode in British politics, each of the parties, from the Greens through the Tories, issued a manifesto outlining their policies, probably sparked by the sort of pseudo-Marxist Jeremy Corbyn, who put out a manifesto. It's meant to be an inspiring bullet point summary of the party's agenda for the country, though of course they're never quite what they promise. So I thought I'd attempt this morning a manifesto for Christian politics based on Paul's words from Romans chapter 12 verses 1 to 2. Because, now don't seem very political words, however in these words Paul is outlining the shape of a new human community, a transformed group of people. And I'm hoping that what follows will not be quite what you expect, but you'll see what I'm getting at, and it will be the foundation of what's to come. So next week I'm going to talk about peace, about making peace. And then the week after that I'm going to talk about tax. So don't miss those two exciting episodes. Next week, peace. The week after that, tax. But here's our manifesto. First of all, number one, Jesus is Lord. No other ruler is Lord. The Christian faith begins with a political, 100% political announcement. And here's the announcement. Jesus is Lord. This is the Apostle Paul's own summary of the Christian gospel. It's a message not about personal spirituality, but about who rules. Who is in charge of the world? The claim of Christianity is quite simple. Jesus is. Who is in charge? Jesus is. Jesus, the crucified and risen Messiah of Israel, is Lord. Who has ultimate power? Jesus Christ. Who governs human affairs? Jesus Christ. For whom do human affairs arrange themselves? Ultimately, Jesus Christ. Now, how do we know he's in charge? Even though he was executed like a criminal, he was declared with power to be the Lord and raised from the dead. Paul opens his letter to the Romans by declaring this. The crucified Messiah is now the risen Lord. That's a pretty impressive mandate. God has declared him to be power, to be Lord, by raising him from the dead. Now, Jesus is Lord is not a private and personal statement. It's not the sort of thing that can be true for you and not true for me. It's out there and it's public. It's either objectively true or it's not true at all. But if Jesus is in charge, it means that other contenders who might appear to be powerful are not, in fact, in charge. Now, this is a marvelously liberating but also sobering thing. Human power is only temporary. If you're in power, as most of us here in some way are, it's sobering because you are only at most number two to Jesus. If you're oppressed, it's liberating because the person oppressing you is not ultimately the one in power. If you're in power, it's sobering. If you're oppressed, it's liberating. I met with some people from the Uyghur minority in China. When I say minority, there's more than 20 million Uyghurs in China. But at the moment, there's actually an active persecution by the Chinese government against this minority in the far west of China. If most of us haven't heard of them, or I hadn't heard of them until I met them. What can I say to an oppressed people, a people who have to face one of the most powerful governments who have ever existed, with all the technology of contemporary surveillance at their disposal, who are opening up re-education camps, even as we speak, to put Uyghur people in it, who are shutting down their businesses? What can I say? Well, the message I pointed them to was that Jesus is Lord, even over the government of China, with all their wealth and all their power and their massive population. That their tyranny is only temporary. This is a liberating truth if you're oppressed, not something we ordinarily think have to consider, but a sobering truth if you're in power. Jesus is Lord. Secondly, the second point of this manifesto is worshipping Jesus is a political statement because he is Lord. So if you are worshipping Jesus, if you worship him, you are making a political statement because you are saying that he is your Lord and that you submit to his rule over your life first and foremost. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about it in this way, but as you come here each week, you are involved in politics. You are a politician. You are making a political statement, especially if you declare your allegiance to the Lord Jesus above and beyond any other power that governs human affairs. As Christians stand each week to declare the creed and say Jesus is Lord, they are making a political statement. Now, you may never have joined a political party, or you might be in another political party. You may never have marched in protest or signed a petition. But if you declare the words, Jesus is Lord, then you are making a huge political statement, a statement that's not just about you, but about the world. We don't know who the Prime Minister is going to be in the next week or even in the next 24 hours. But no disrespect to whoever that might be. Once you just stand to declare Jesus is Lord, you are saying that whoever that person's power is only derives from the rule of Jesus Christ. Okay, so, but what kind of ruler is Jesus? And that's the third point of my manifesto here. The third point is, Jesus is a crucified Lord who rules his kingdom by humble service. The truth is that we know power in human life mostly in its distorted forms, as self-assertion, self-aggrandizement, narcissism, exploitation, abuse, and even as tyranny. We know that power is used to serve the powerful, even in a relatively fair society like our own. Now, last year I guided a tour around Europe. I think I actually came here and spoke before that about the Reformation, and we were exploring Europe. The Europe of 500 years ago. And as you go around the cities of contemporary Europe, you can see how the rulers of 500 years ago, of 800 years ago, of 300 years ago, of 100 years ago, asserted their power and displayed their wealth. They built mighty castles and palaces. They erected enormous statues of themselves. They send the message, this is how power works, through beating down the other contenders. We went to Prague. In the 1950s, Prague had the distinction of having the largest statue of Stalin in the world. This was a thing, apparently, to have the largest statue of Stalin in the world. Today, you can go and see the spot where the largest statue of Stalin stood. They completed it, I believe, in 1952. Stalin died in 1953 and then was denounced by his own party. And it was hurriedly taken down from Prague. This enormous display of apparently immovable eternal power lasted just relatively an instant. You can see from these edifices how human power, we think human power works, through beating down and dominating other contenders. In his letter to the Romans, Paul has explained at great length how Jesus Christ is a different kind of ruler. The sign of his rule is not the palace or the castle or the statue, but the cross on which he died. The story of Jesus the Lord is the story not of a crushing rule, but of a freely given grace despite everything that human beings are. Instead of God paying us the wages of sin, which is death, he offers us a righteousness which is not our own, free of charge. He makes peace with us even when we are his enemies. And that means Jesus' Lord is the humble Lord. He rules not by the exercise of muscle, but by the humble service of those he is given to rule. Oh, we have echoes of it in our culture. We call the rulers of our country ministers, servants, the prime minister, the first servant. But of course we know we don't really believe that in the end. But Jesus was the humble Lord. This tells us everything about how Jesus' followers are to go about doing politics, to think about power. Christian politics is not about a grab for power. It's not about electing Christian officials so we can Christianize the country. It's not about coercing the state to accept Christian values. It's not about setting up a Christian society. And this is where our text for today comes in, which acts as a kind of heading for the next two talks. Well, have a look at Romans chapter 12 and verse 2. Do not be conformed to this world, the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. And this is what Christian politics should look like on the ground. This is what worshipping Jesus Christ looks like day by day. It has a particular shape to it. Not conformed to the pattern of the world, but transformed. Not conformed, but transformed. And this is where my last two points of my manifesto come in, and they're really the flip side of one another. Firstly, Christian politics means not conforming to the world and its idea of power. Christian politics means not conforming to the world and its idea of power. The mission for the Christian church and for Christians as individuals is to be non-conformists. As Paul says here, do not conform to the pattern of this world. Now, in the human society, we don't tend to like non-conformists. We like everyone to be and act the same. That's what we learned in high school, because we bullied the kids who were non-conformists, right? Didn't you? Didn't we? That we don't like people who stand out. We like everyone to be and act the same. We sometimes celebrate some non-conformists, but usually after the fact, when their ideas have been vindicated and everyone started copying them and conforming to them. And how does conformity work? And we don't here live in a totalitarian regime where we're told directly what to wear. We all have to walk around in the same pair of pyjamas, or how to behave and what to think. But society still acts to pressure us to conform to its values and norms in more subtle ways. We are taught what to think and how to act by the education system, by the media, by advertising, and by those around us. These act like a mould into which we are poured. The really shocking thing about the way this happens, I think, is that it gets us in the heart, not the head. I've been thinking about advertising this week, and especially after hearing Max Jagannathan speak a couple of weeks ago here, that advertising, you know, we all sit there and we all know rationally that advertising is stupid. We know that, you know, buying a certain kind of suit's not going to make us more sexy. But then we see the advertising, and even though rationally we're telling ourselves that's not going to happen, emotionally it works. Emotionally, in our hearts, we actually do get conformed to it. Extraordinary power, this mould that's there for us to fit into, into which we conform, even though we rationally know we shouldn't. And mostly this conformity is harmless. You're told what kind of haircut a middle-aged bloke should have, and what kind of lifestyle accessories, and you find yourself getting a middle-aged bloke, as a middle-aged bloke, that's me, going out and getting just those things. But we're also told some more sinister things that we all tend to believe without question. For example, we are told that power and success comes from asserting yourself over others. We celebrate Steve Jobs, who's being a jerk at work. It was almost celebrated. That's a reason. His disagreeableness actually made him the hero that he's become in our culture. We're told to despise the weak. We're told to applaud self-assertion, and that you have to step over the bodies of other people to get to the top. And if you do, then that's admirable. There's a sort of beauty to ruthlessness that we admire. We tend to believe that if people are failures, they deserve it. And you believe that, because I believe it in my heart. If people are failures, they deserve it. We're told there's a certain standard of beauty, especially for women, and if we don't attain it, then we aren't really a socially acceptable person. But Paul says, don't be conformed to the world. The Christians are to be non-conformists. I remember living in the United Kingdom in the late 1970s when the punk movement swept through. And there were people who started, I was only young, but there were people, quite shocking, I can remember people wearing safety pins in their noses and torn clothes and outrageous mohawk hair that made them 6'6" high and spitting at each other and singing songs about anarchy and calling themselves things like Sid Vicious and Johnny Rotten. And the tabloids were hysterical about this movement. People were afraid that this was the end of society as they knew it. Punk challenged, well, really it spat on all the conventions of society, including being what a nice person was. Well, that's one form of nonconformity, isn't it? And it was threatening because it refused to accept conventional thinking. Now, of course, then people threw a whole bunch of money at the punks and they proved to be pretty much like everyone else in the movement, petered out. But Christians are called not to be like the punk movement and be a blip on the horizon of history, on the page of history, but to maintain the rage. Not, you'll be glad to know, by getting outrageous hairstyles or by sticking safety pins in their noses or by living a life that isn't, but by living a life that isn't shaped by what the world thinks of about power. Remember, our model is Jesus. We simply don't accept that being poor makes you a loser. We don't think it's acceptable or admirable to get to the top by using people. We simply don't accept that the point of being human is to be as beautiful as you can, or that we are fulfilled as human beings by acquiring things or buying experiences. That is more countercultural and revolutionary than sticking a needle in your lip. But it's easy to say, don't conform. But how is that non-conforming going to work? Well, that's the fifth point of the manifesto. Christian politics means being transformed by the renewing of your mind. Transformed by renewing of your mind. He says here, be transformed by the renewing of your mind, then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing and perfect will. Don't be conformed, but be transformed. The original language uses that wonderful word, metamorphosis. It means be utterly transformed, as the caterpillar to the butterfly is transformed, starting with the renewing of your mind or your mindset, your attitude. Notice that a Christian politics doesn't talk about changing the world, but rather about being changed. The manifesto for a Christian politics is not primarily about changing others, but about being changed, being a different kind of person and a different kind of community. I think this is markedly different from the way we do politics at the moment. At the moment, we focus on the problems everybody else has. Whereas the Christian attitude to politics is change me. I'm going to be changed. And how? We learn what is right and wrong, what is good and acceptable and perfect, what God's good and pleasing and perfect will is, not by looking at social conventions or reading the newspaper or by saying, for heaven's sake, it's 2018. That seems to be the full extent of ethical thinking in our contemporary society is, it's 2018. Ergo, catch up with the times, but by opening our minds to the will of God, which is why the activity at the centre of the Christian life and the centre of Christian community is studying to know the character of God and his ways in the scriptures. If we were to look the way the world is, we'd think that being strong and despising the weak was the right thing to do, that there's an honour and nobility in doing just that. Certainly, this was the way of the Roman Empire. If you read the Stoics and others, this is exactly what they thought. They despised the weak. This is exactly what Nietzsche thought in the 19th century. His influence is everywhere with us today. And he despised Christianity as a religion of milksops and wimps. It was the religion that had sand kicked in its face on the beach. That's not Nietzsche's words, by the way. But it's when we open our minds to the God of the Bible, the God of Jesus Christ, that we discover a different way. We discover that humility and forgiveness and mercy and patience and generosity and kindness and serving others are the secrets to a good human life. And so if you want to do something political, why not engage with the God of Jesus Christ? Why not start a habit of engaging with him day by day in his word and praying to him these radical nonconformist political acts, more radical than get up? A Christian politics is not about asserting yourself over others so that we can force them to change. A Christian politics is about being changed by knowing the will of God. A Christian politics is radical because it refuses to accept what the world says about power and beauty and self-fulfillment. It exposes just how destructive these forces are, and it says, here is a different way, the way of Jesus Christ, the way of humility, the way of care for others, the way of service. And so, in this time of huge anxiety about politics, here's a different way to do it. Jesus Christ teaches us that true power isn't about flexing your muscles. It isn't about being transformed. It is about being transformed so we are more like him. The most effective political thing you could do is to open yourself to being transformed by the grace of God. And that's what Christians should aim to be. If you're not a Christian, you're observing Christians, that is what you should call Christians to account for. That's what they should be. That's what they should look like. A people who are metamorphosed by Jesus Christ. And by living lives that show Jesus Christ is Lord, Christians will be engaging in the most effective political program ever devised. It has had its impact on history in remarkable ways. Now, can you imagine an Australia where assumptions about power and success are actually challenged by a community of people, not anxious, remarkably not anxious, but willing to be transformed themselves? A community of people in the midst of our nation who refuse to accept that what is normal is actually good. Someone here says, there's no advertising that could sell the idea of being persecuted or being martyred. Do you have any comments about the politics of persecution or the politics of martyrdom? Yeah, I wrote a book. My PhD was on martyrdom, so I've got a lot of comments about martyrdom. So this is a very dangerous question. Never ask a doctoral student what they wrote their doctorate on if you don't have 3 hours spare. Martyrdom is the image of the Christian life and the Christian attitude to politics. It's the exemplar, if you like, of what a Christian should be like in relation to the world's power. Because a martyr goes to his or her death because Jesus is Lord. Now, interestingly, the martyrs of the early church, they honoured the emperor. And this comes out in chapter 12 and 13 of Paul's letter to the Romans too. They said to those who then put them to death, they said, we pray for you, we honour you, and we respect your authority, but only as authority derived from Christ. And it's we cannot put down that authority. And so they had no fear of those who persecuted them because they acknowledged a higher power. They honoured a crucified and risen Lord. This was only what, in fact, Jesus himself had gone through. And so I think this is very important because sometimes amongst the Christian community there's a paranoia that we're about to enter an age of persecution. And that may be so, but it's really important that the Christian church does not act in an anxious way and never forgets that it's there to be for others. And that really also that it's our own transformation that we seek. So I think we of course speak against religious persecution. We speak as much as possible. We pipe up about that, but we don't do what the world does and plead the victim. So one of the ways in which contemporary conversation in politics works is that you ironically get power by proving how much of a victim you are, and so therefore you get moral authority, therefore you get power through showing how powerless you are, ironically. And I don't think we do that. I don't think Christians should do that. I think the way Christians speak is for the sake of others and resting in the power of Christ. One way I want to demonstrate this is by speaking up for the religious freedom of others, including atheists. And so I've personally written a couple of articles about the religious freedom of Mormons. I'm very happy to do that. And I think that actually serves to speak to religious freedom in general and shows that I'm not actually just interested in my own space. I'm actually interested in the common good. And I think that's a good way to go. In fact, it's interesting, you're right, there's no advertising that could sell the idea of being persecuted or being martyred, and yet that's the New Testament. You know, it's interesting, Jesus's the Beatitudes. Who are the blessed people? Who are the blessed people in the world? It's kind of anti-evangelism when Jesus speaks in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, the blessed people are those who are going to be persecuted. Come and follow me and take up your own cross, because you're going to die like me. Good news, right? Very interesting that he puts it in that way. Got more to say, of course. Fred Daly, a politician from the 50s and 60s, once famously said, kick a man when he's down because you may never get to kick him again. Do you think that our society has descended to this level? It's getting worse, or is this what we should expect? Now, I don't know if it's getting worse or not. It was very interesting that... now, what's the name of the Chinese premier? Jiaping. All I heard was mumble mumble there, but there was a ping. He said recently, we in China don't follow the ethos in the West where we turn the other cheek, right? We don't follow that ethos. We don't do that. Now, interestingly, I don't think we follow that ethos in the West, but it was interesting to hear a Chinese premier quote the words of Jesus back at us in the West and say, you guys are wimps because you follow that. If only we followed that kind of way of thinking. I think particularly in the world of business, I think what we've got is a ruthless dog-eat-dog ethos. I think that's the way we've educated our children. Basically, it's a dog-eat-dog world, so who's going to win? A dog, so you've got to be a dog, is what's happening. I think society is certainly like that. I don't know if things are getting worse or better, but certainly I think that's the way we instinctively think about it. Jesus rules by humble service, yet why do we see churches build castles across many cities and towns, even many in Australia? Built like castles. That's interesting. I guess there's Gothic architecture, which kind of looks castle-like. Nowadays, of course, we don't build... churches are not built like castles. They're built like shopping centres, which is interesting. They look more like shopping centres or local swimming pools when we build them. Says something about the dominance of consumerism that churches are trying to speak into that landscape. I think the underlying part of the question is the church seems like a powerful institution, and I think that's right. I think churches have fallen for the allure of state power, and very often that has corrupted the mission of the church. You'll see this particularly in Europe, where you've got a church tax. And the state church, often the Protestant church, has become a state church, and that, I think, partly explains why those churches are completely empty and impotent. Because rather than the state being influenced by the church, it's gone entirely the other way around. That's certainly happening with the Church of England. In England, the pressure for the Church of England is not to have a prophetic voice speaking to the state, but to actually just conform to what the state wants, to baptise what the state wants. And it's been doing that for many years. Of course, they blessed the guns of the First World War. So the church really needs to hear that, a challenge, and to take it very, very seriously and to beware being too cozy with those who are in power. We see that in various ways in America at the moment. We've lost the ability to engage with civility, I said. Was there ever a time when public debate was civil? Has polite engagement in the public space ever achieved anything? What do you think of Jesus' warning that son will be sent against father and mother against daughter? Have we ever been civil? I think if you went and you saw a town hall debate 50, 60, 70 years ago, I would think you would see, or if you went to Parliament in the 1940s and 50s, I think you would see a much more civil environment. I think you would see much more cooperative work. That's just my historical hunch, and from what I've seen, I think there is a coarsening of public discourse in all kinds of ways, and this is inflamed by Twitter, by our ability to sit in our own living room and do what John Milbank, the English theologian, says, which is clubbing each. He calls it clubbing each other to death over the internet, which is what we're doing. We're kind of, you know, we're allowed to. It's sort of like if we all have motorcycle helmets on, we can't see each other's faces, so it's okay to, you can just kill someone you can't see their face. I mean, it's like that, isn't it? And that's, I think, much, much worse. Has polite engagement ever achieved anything? Well, I think, yes, polite engagement does achieve a lot. I think polite engagement may not achieve ruthless ends, immediate ends, but I think it actually achieves it achieves a much more peaceable public square. It is actually also, it's non-anxious, because, and I think Christians also, we're not result driven, we're not utilitarian, so it might be that we lose, but because we win in the long run, we're happy to come, because we've got the sovereign Lord, then we're happy to not to the way we do things is actually important. So if Christians were, for instance, to be involved in a public campaign on a social issue, then it would be wrong of Christians to stoop to the level of public discourse that we see all around us. For instance, using scare tactics or using advertising that's misleading. That would be entirely wrong, even if the cause was good. Let the readers understand. So polite engagement achieves maybe not the ends of winning the debate, but achieves something far more important, I think. I think I'm going to set aside the comment about Jesus, because that involves quite a lot of Jesus' word about conflict. I think he is saying, yes, the world will be hostile to you, and there will be division because of his gospel, but it's not because Christians cause division. In fact, Paul says, we'll see next week, live as far as it's up to you, live at peace with everybody. And I think that's not an option for Christians. We will be in conflict, but it won't be because we have been jerks. I think this is my motto. Given that Jesus is Lord, is it right for Christians to legislate Christian morality for the general population? If Christians believe Jesus is wise and good, shouldn't they enforce Jesus' way of life, abortion, euthanasia, censorship of pornography? Now, that's very interesting, because you're right. What is good is good. What is good for all. It's not as if there's one right over here and another over here. It's true. And this is always the tension for Christians, because we have to allow maximum, maximum freedom, because we know that we need to allow space for people to come to Christ in their hearts. That's been the basis of religious freedom, is actually to allow, get the state out of religion so that religion can prosper. People can actually make proper, non-coerced decisions for themselves about their religious faith. That's been really important. However, it's really important that we don't just sort of step aside and say, "No, this isn't true." And I think we need to argue persuasively in the public square. Though that's important. Sometimes people hear us just saying, "Well, the Bible says it, and so therefore it must be." We need to argue persuasively in the public square with those who don't agree with our premises. I think we should do that, and I think I've answered the question there. What is good is good. However, it's worth saying that there's a bunch of Christians are often selective on the issues that they focus on. So we're often, and it depends whether you're a right-leaning Christian or a left-leaning Christian, and often you mirror actually the political program that you support. And I think we should try not to be too selective on that. Isn't change me... Are you about to stop me?
Well, I was thinking, given that you're back here the next 2 weeks, how about you
take these questions and answer them again, or incorporate them?
Incorporate them or answer them at the start of next week.
Terrific.
Is that okay?
So, thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.